ngicela uhambe uyofuna umsebenzi.
Uzoyithola kanjani selukhonene?
Yonke into, impahla, imali.
This adulting thing, hey.
Uhamba imali.
Uthi nakayithoka challenge.
Awuna moto, imali. Fanele kube nemali phakathi.
Sebenza.
Sebenza. Sebenza.
Yabamntanam.
Sebenza.
Welcome once again to another episode of the Sebenza Life podcast, Behind the Hustle. Today we're sitting with someone very special. Hi, Rosie.
How are you today?
I'm good.
Good.
So we're sitting with Rosie Mudene. She is an actress. She is a producer. She is a presenter. She has directed. She runs an agency. She's an author. Before I run out of breath, spend the entire podcast listing your achievements. Who is Rosie Mudene outside all of those jobs and amazing work that you do?
First and foremost, I'm a daughter of the soil. I'm a sister to many, biological, blood, distant African sense.
Yes.
And then I'm me, the young little girl still trying to find herself.
Mm.
The little emotional creature who's still facing her fears, but admitting to them.
That is beautiful.
Yeah.
And all the work you also do, you're also quite an activist as well.
Absolutely.
Tell me more about that.
That is my other life. So I have my life that sometimes doesn't, but a lot of the time gives me money in the bank.
Mm.
And then I have the other one that pays the soul. And that is helping women and children.
Mm.
It started over 17 years ago with Power when I trained through people opposing woman abuse.
Yes.
And then I started working with children and I realized that working on that level of activism is another type of strength, and I realize I don't have that. And so I joined the board of Childline and worked extensively on advocacy around children's rights, protecting children, getting children out of abused homes and so forth. But even then, after a while, it takes its toll. And so my main focus since then, since I resigned from the board, has been just advocating for women, not only creating awareness around abuse and what our rights are on abuse, but also just level of empowerment. You know, as black women, yes, we're told we're strong black women, but no one reminds us that we're also emotional, that we're human. We're allowed to cry. We're allowed to say, I can't do this. We're allowed to say, I need help. And when we do that, we're also allowed to be in a space where people should respect that. You know, so a lot of my empowerment and my talks and sending the message out there is that we can have it all, we can do it all, but we also remember we got to do it at a human pace.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, how does one deal with that toll? I mean, it's a huge responsibility.
Yeah.
Especially when you deal with people who have to even find the agency to receive help. How do you personally deal with it?
You know, it's every case and every month is different.
Mm.
You know, some months I feel I'm incredibly strong and I can keep on going. Other months, then I need to take a bit of a step back and either go into therapy, spend some alone time with Rosie.
Mm.
I spend a lot of time with God, and I know that's where a lot of my strength, comes from. Not a lot of it, all of it comes from. But it's also a calling that he put me on this path. So that's why I know that even at times when I think, whoa, I need time off.
Let me breathe.
Am I going to get through this? It's literally sitting down and saying, okay, you put me on this path. Where are we going?
Mm.
Because at this moment, these tears are like, it's getting too much. But it's a journey that I'm glad that I've had the opportunity to do. And I still know I've got a lot more to do.
Mm.
But it's essential because a lot of the time, it's literally about conversations that people have about ourselves, about our self-esteem, about what we allow, about what we're afraid of talking about.
Mm.
You know, and then it goes against the so-called societal taboos. Don't talk about what happens in somebody's relationship or what's happening in the family. Keep it behind closed doors.
Mm.
That's why it's been, we're in a crisis because our country, not even our country, our continent is in a crisis.
Mm.
And that's because people have said, well, don't talk about abuse. Nobody wants to hear it. And then you get the victim blaming. Some of our judicial system and some policemen have a problem in reporting some of these crimes. So then people don't want to report it because then they think they're not going to be believed. So it's this vicious circle. And slowly but surely, as activists over the last two decades, we're breaking down that vicious circle and actually putting the facts on the table and saying, well, people won't speak out because they're not believed, because society says, well, if you raped you, there's a stigma attached to you. No, the stigma should be attached to the abuser.
Mm.
You know, so it's a journey that I'm on.
Now, with the different roles you play in the work that you do,
mm.
what difficulties do you find often when circumnavigating a world where you're around people who sort of make others feel marginalized, especially mm. in a male-dominated industry?
Yeah. You know, it's very, very difficult, and it's a great question that you've asked, because the last 5 to 7 years, I'm still trying to navigate that.
Mm.
I gave up acting for a while because I needed to hone in on my agency and also hone in on my producing and directing skills. And I was presenting a show which took me around the continent. So I wasn't really based in South
Studio
Africa.
Studio 53.
Yes. With Gaetano Kagwa.
Some of us are still fans.
And so I didn't really have to navigate it as much in terms of people's perceptions of abuse and of activism. But then when I came back to the country mm. and back to acting and got into set and then was a lot more aware of what was happening around me and realizing that we still don't have rights as actors and actresses on set.
Mm.
You know, somebody pointed out from the South African Guild of Actors was that, you know, our contract states that if you come to work drugged or you come to work drunk, you're going to get fired.
Wow.
But it doesn't say anything that if you get raped or harassed on set. You know, so it's and as independent practitioners and as freelancers, mm. we don't fall under the Labor Act. So we don't have HR companies that you can, well, HR departments mm. that you can go to and then file a case of sexual harassment and so forth. So we're not protected. You know, so that's why it's we're at a stage where people are talking about these issues more,
mm.
and people are stepping up. So the work that SAGA are doing, they're changing bills, they're changing some of our laws and working around our contracts and so that people are protected on that level.
Mm.
Then number two, then it's creating the awareness on set, so letting people know that. As a sound person, when you put your wire on me, you got to ask me first before you touch me. Second of all, don't stick your hand down my pants or stick it up my bra.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not funny. But for many, many years, people have gotten away with that because girls or even guys were too scared to even say anything.
Mm.
You know, it's a known fact, the casting couch, and it happens in the music industry also where you want to get to the top, you're going to have to either get on your knees or you're going to have to sleep with this person and so forth.
Mm.
And people are doing it because there's nobody who's protected them. You know, I've spoken to many, many survivors over the last couple of years and it's not just men who have been protecting the perpetrators. There's also a lot of women who've been protecting them. And it goes back to the whole philosophy of, well, we had to do it. What makes you so different? You know, and that is also one of the biggest problems in society is abuse and harassment and all these different things have been happening to so many people that it's become the norm.
Mm.
So when you do speak out, they were like, well, what makes you so special? You know, and when I got
that's
back,
that's the worst thing to hear.
You know, and it's a reality.
Mm.
You know, and when I got back from Botswana, it was an incident that happened when somebody smashed my nose in.
Yeah.
And it was, and I went to social media for assistance because I couldn't get assistance on the ground when I was there.
Mm.
And one of the tweets, and that tweet was literally a turning point in my life, and it said, "Women have been beaten up every single day. Why is it a big thing? Because it happened to Rosie Mutene."
Mm.
And I was like, whoa, first of all, that was hard hitting, but it was the truth. Why was it a big thing? Because it was happening to me. It should be a big thing when it happens to anybody. And that was the turning point for me because I realized, okay, I need to heal and I cannot let this case go because that is a cry, a call out for help. That means that person, and by the way, that tweet came from a woman. So if she is saying that something has happened to her,
yeah.
when nobody listened to her.
Now I'm glad you touched on this particular issue because you do mention it in your book, mm. Reclaiming the Soil.
Yes.
Let's go into that. What was that process like? Taking the pen or sitting behind the computer and writing
yeah.
the story of your life.
You know, it came out of a place of pain,
mm.
of betrayal. I was in heavy sessions of counselling. And my counselor said to me, my therapist said to me, she was like, just put your pen to paper and mm-hmm. write and write. And at the time it was therapeutic and that was for my healing. Mm. And then a couple of years went by and I was still writing.
Mm.
And while I was, I mean, obviously the therapy sessions didn't last as long, fortunately for me.
Mm.
But I realized that there were still a lot of pains that I hadn't dealt with and a lot of trauma that I hadn't dealt with. And so when I got to that, I was like, okay, I can't write anymore, but I need to deal with this.
Mm.
And it's so interesting is that when you're used to, when you have a low self-esteem growing up and you're used to trauma, you actually get, you get so used to it that you actually just block out some of it. So when I had to go back, I realized, whoa, Rosie, what happened to you there was
yeah.
serious.
Yeah.
You need to deal with this. You need to find healing. Some of my traumas I will never find. I will never find that healing. But at least I've moved on from it. I'm not ignored it. I haven't ignored it. And so then after I'd like dealt with certain traumas, then I went back to the writing. And then I got to a point where I was, when my therapist was like, well, when you're ready, you know, you do have a book. And I was like, there's no way I'm putting my life out for all and sundry and so forth. And then after a while, you know, speaking to people about my life and so forth and realizing that different parts of my story relate to different parts of people around the world. Mm. And then something said to me, you know what, your story needs to be told. And when you put yourself out there, it's more about the fear and what people are going to say and how they're going to react. And that also then took another 2 years. So the book was finished and it was just sitting there.
Mm.
The publisher was like, what's going on? You know, I just ignored my publisher for a good couple of months.
Mm.
But then I got to the point where actually, you know what? My story does need to be told. And, I knew that it was going to hurt, bring a bit of pain for a lot of people.
Mm.
I knew it was going to be frustrated for a lot of people. Hence, I changed some of the names and that was a request on their part.
Yes.
But also it was very, very important, especially, I don't want to give too much of the book away for those who haven't read it, but for my biological family who I never ever treated properly.
Mm.
And it sounds weird, but I literally always put them on the back burner because I was brought up thinking white was right and followed my white side of the family. And then when you get this level of betrayal, when I literally thought, well, my white side of the family have turned their backs on me, and then I've got my black family, do I even dare turn to them?
Where do you begin?
And when I did turn to them, there was no retaliation. There was no anger. I know there was anger that they were feeling, but they didn't show it towards me.
Mm.
And that made me also realize that the difference between conditional and unconditional love and the importance of your bloodline and the importance of having family in your life, you know, and that's why I was like, okay, well, that's why the book needs to come out, because not only to talk about those issues, but also to honor my parents, two powerful people who, fortunately, just before Papa passed away, I got to know the true man of who he was.
Yeah.
And now being able to honor Mama and she really understanding who her crazy daughter is, you know, for so many years, just like looked at me like, who is this person that I gave birth to? You know? And I mean, the conversation that we have now is, and there's a lot of questions that will still always be unanswered, but it's okay. But for me, it's a pact that I've made with myself and a pact that I've made with God. Is that I never ever want to put my mother through any more pain because I've given her so much pain in the past.
Mm.
Yes, I've given her a lot of success, a lot of pride and so forth in terms of my success. But growing up, I was a brat. You know, I did things even in my early adult life that I'm not proud of. But I had to be honest about it and face that so that I don't do that again. And also, you know, the other point, sorry to cut you off, was that interracial adoption is there and I don't have anything against it. But I think people need to understand that when you do go into, I mean, when you're going to be a parent, it's one thing.
Yeah.
You're taking on a huge responsibility. But when you're going into an adoption of another race, creed, religion, you've got to do the triple amount of homework. You've got to be able to and be willing to do the triple amount of work. So it's about what are you feeding the child. Not even physically, but even what are you feeding the child mentally and emotionally? What stories are you telling at the dinner table? What black stories are you telling at the dinner table? What white stories are you, be careful that you're not saying? So it's conversations about, well, when I was younger, when I was naughty and I was born in a village called Pogeng, which is in Rustenburg, I was told, you know, if you do that again, we're going to send you to Rustenburg. So,
yes, I remember this one.
You know, and so that became a place of fear. My first boyfriend, well, I call him my first boyfriend, was the first boy I ever called my house, and told my foster family that he was from Soweto. I was automatically told, you stay away from boys from Soweto because they're going to rape you. So it's these type of things that you've got to be careful what you're teaching your children. And also, how many times are you telling them what their physical features, how beautiful they are. So I hated my hair. I hated my bum. I hated my face. I hated my skin color. Even because apartheid was, it was in the midst of apartheid. So even the law stated that, you know, so if you're going to be going into that interracial adoption, then you've got to take all of these things into account. Otherwise, rather not do it. Language is also very, very important. You know, as much as I'm really, really trying, and I'm not great with languages, but I can understand a lot more of Tswana than what I did before, and I'm learning to speak a bit more. And it's more the ego that I've like pushed aside because I speak like a white person and I speak with an accent. But the importance of language, you know, and when I speak to linguists and they talk about how every word, every African word means something. It's not just a word. It's connected to something. That is powerful. That is what I missed out growing up. I missed out on the power of culture, of tradition, and hence the name of my book, Reclaiming the Soil. And it's literally me going and grabbing what I can. And a lot has fallen between my fingers. But what is if it's in my palm of my hand, I am going to nurture that until I die.
And I've actually got to say, I've been very curious as to why haven't you translated the book yet? Because I know a lot of people still to this day turn heads going, okay, it's Rosemudan from generations, you know? Is there going to be maybe a translation to the book? That
God
would be quite
willing, from your mouth to God's ears. You know, I'm working very well. The book was also was chosen for the One City One Book campaign in Itakwini. So I'm doing that rollout. But then also I'm working with, and I've got to remember the acronym. So it's the Pan South African Language Lab. That's it. and I've just partnered with them, which is really, really exciting. And the reason why I contacted them and I said to them, I said, well, language is such an important part of our culture. And it's great that we're finally noticing that and pushing that out. And use me as a guinea pig on why it is important. Because I've lost out on a lot. There's a void in me that will never be filled purely because of that language barrier. And we cannot allow those mistakes to happen again. And so, God willing, within the next couple of months, we'll be able to find the funding. And for me, I'd like to translate it into all official languages because it's about getting that book to all four corners of the world, whether it's talking about creating awareness on abuse, whether it's interfaith adoption, interracial adoption. Also, just being a teenager and growing up. I mean, you've read it, but I mean, there's incidents where I talk about where we stole a car and we nearly drove it.
There were some moments that I was like, I feel you guys.
this is triggering my memories. Yeah.
And speaking of the book, actually, you know, it's you had the power to be able to tell your story and get it out there. And one of the stories that you mentioned was during the when you accosted in one of the soapies and you had a cancer scare.
Yeah.
I mean, for those who read the book, probably unbeknownst to them, there was also an incident in the situation where you were dealing with a lot of molestation and whatnot. And I don't know, I felt like there's constantly this issue where young black women in the industry, especially in the entertainment industry, are constantly blackballed from other issues.
Yeah.
My question, though, I guess, is do you feel that this can ever change? And how do we change that? How do we get the voice of young black women heard?
Oh, such a powerful question. And that's why I do the work that I do, because it's about creating safe spaces, number one, for us to share our stories. For us to share our stories in a space where the next person, even if they don't understand the pain, will at least believe you. Because for too long, black women, we haven't been listening to each other. We haven't been believing each other. So it's about creating that. And then, you know, creating other spaces where we can tell our stories our way. So Shonda Rhimes, what she's doing in America in terms of the story she's telling through all of her different projects. You know, I found out about a month ago that she actually wrote the story of Dorothy Dandridge. You know? So I think if we can get the Shonda Rhimes within South Africa, the Shonda Rhimes in East Africa, all around the world, where although it's not going to come out on a big scale, but we tell our stories our most authentic way. Number one. Number two, it's about the women who are on the legal side. It's about changing those policies, pushing that advocacy on behalf of the people who don't know how to do the legal route. It's about the woman on the in the police and the judicial side. you were doing what's right and not taking those bribes, not undermining somebody when they walk in to open up a case or when they tell a story and laugh about it and undermine it.
Mm.
So it's a, and a lot of it is, it's also about what conversations we're having with our children.
Mm.
What are we having at the dinner table? What are you telling your son? What are you telling your daughter about roles in the house? It's about the conversations the guys are having after a game,
yeah,
or at the pub or wherever they are. And if somebody says, well, a racist joke, or not a racist, or racist joke even,
mm,
or a sexist joke about a underage girl,
mm,
are you laughing or are you reprimanding them?
Mm.
Because remember, these apologists have been able to do, these rapists have been able to do a lot of the stuff that they're doing is because somebody will always apologize for them. So they've always been operating in safe spaces.
Mm.
You know, I dated a guy many years ago, and his business partner used to make sexual advances on me.
Mm.
And we used to argue. I used to argue with him. I said, "Well, as my partner, you need to stand in my defense,
mm,
and in my honor." And his argument was always, "Well, I didn't see it. I can't do anything." And I was like, "Yes, but I'm telling you." And so for partners, for husbands, mm, for wives, for girlfriends, for boyfriends, whatever your sexual orientation is that we need to listen. And if you don't understand, then ask and find a way to get that empathy, because everything has just been washed over. And you look at the R. Kelly case.
Yeah.
It's been happening for years because it was happening to black girls. Let's be honest.
Mm.
You know.
I never thought of it that way. And
yeah.
It kind of hit me a little bit.
It's hard hitting, yeah, you know. And yes, I'm not saying that hasn't happened to Asian or white girls or Indian girls or, you know. But the thing is, when it comes to black women and us owning, mm, and validating our pain, we've never really been given the platform. You look at our grandmothers and our mothers. They've, mm, worked. I mean, my mother is, she's a powerhouse. I call her my queen because she raised other people's children, watched her child being raised by somebody else,
mm,
and not once did have any criticism, or not once has ever come down on me or anything,
mm,
you know. And only in my adulthood did I look back and think, wow. And then on top of it, you had a daughter who was a brat to you and refused to call you mama.
Mm.
You know, and my mother's one of the queens out of many. You know, you see the gorgos who are still walking in the fields and working in the fields or working in the factories,
mm,
and getting minimum wage, but still come to work and they give the best job and they're still smiling, they're still living their lives and they're still looking after their families. You know, mm, so we need to reprogram our minds about how we see black women,
mm,
and how we see women. And then the conversations can start. I mean, the fact that we having to beg Banyane to be paid properly.
Yeah.
Just being paid. I mean, they're winning. It would be a different story if they're not winning, but they're winning. And to be paid just a minimal amount compared to what the Bafana are getting, who are losing.
My next question there would be, how do women,
mm,
get other women to have those same conversations? Because you find spaces or workspaces especially,
yeah,
where another woman wouldn't have the same, mm, sort of thoughts about standing up against something.
Yeah. You know what? It's about decolonizing our patriarchal minds,
mm,
literally. You know, somebody said to me, well, you know, why are you not helping out the woman within the sports industry? And I'm like, well, I'm one person. My industry is entertainment. And I'm not, mm, saying that what the woman in the sports industry
aren't experiencing it. Yeah.
But we also need pockets within the woman who are sitting at the boardroom tables,
mm,
who are sitting in the booths and who see it. You need to step up and stand up.
Mm.
And nobody wants to take that step because then you're going to be the odd one out. And unfortunately, well, fortunately for me, I've taken that step.
Mm.
That is part of my journey. I know that is where I need to go, and that's why I will do it. But we still need to find those other people in those other areas to step up and actually say, no, that's not cool.
Mm.
Or I did see him do that. Or no, you're not overreacting. Or even, are you okay?
Mm. What advice would you give to people who want to speak out and maybe, mm, feel like, okay, if I do this, I'm going to upset a few people, I'm, yeah, going to rock boat?
First and foremost is that support therapy and counseling 100% all the, mm, way. So before you even go out is that seek assistance from a therapist.
Mm.
And when I mean seek assistance, it's if you need to cry, you go and you cry. If you need to be angry, you go and you be angry. Because,
yeah,
when you do step out, remember there's going to be those pessimist attitudes that people are going to be questioning you. And when you stand in your truth, nobody can throw you over. But when you're going in and you're quivering and you're still not sure about how to say it, it's not about that it didn't happen or that not what you're feeling. It's about how to say it and to be okay with what you're saying. Don't say it at all. You know, I'm in my book, I don't talk about my sexual violence. I don't talk about the fact that when I was at university, I was raped because it took me a long time for me to even say these words without quivering. And I needed to be able to say that when it did come out and it wasn't planned, it just came out that, I'm ready to talk about it, was because I knew I was standing within my own power. And we all have our different times and different lengths that it takes for us to reach that point. And if I had done therapy straight away after it happened, maybe it would have been shorter. But it didn't. But, you can't cry over spilt milk. So that's why when I say to people is that when something happens, deal with it then and there emotionally and psychologically. And then seek the advice and so forth. Sometimes people just come out and we speak about it. Then we can work around that. But it is better just to heal yourself first before you open your mouth. Because we've got to be realistic. There is going to be those negative attitudes.
How do you deal with that? Especially because you do have social media presence, especially on Twitter. And that's perhaps maybe the most contentious of them all. So how do you deal with that?
You know, I still do therapy. I have an amazing group of warrior women and men around me. I'm even going to name them. It's Tokozani Ndaba, Lebogang Mashile, Ingeborg Lichtenberg, Jack Devrin, and Devnerain. I always get his surname wrong from South Africa, who's the chairperson of South African Guild of Actors. I have my school friends, you know. So when the tough gets going, when things are really, really at the worst, one of them will pick it up. So it's a call like, okay, do you need to cry? What's going on? If it's really, really bad, then it's me going into therapy and dealing with that. But it's also learning to get a thick skin. You know, I was speaking to somebody yesterday about, you know, it's wonderful, but it's also scary rise of people calling themselves activists. And it's great that people want to take a stand. But understand that when you get onto that platform, there are going to be more daggers coming towards you than people actually praising you for it. And so when the daggers come, protect yourself. You've got your shield up. You know what I mean? It's like you've toughened up your skin. Expect it, because you've got to break through those daggers before you can clear the war room. Because a lot of people, as going back to what we were saying before, is that a lot of people don't want to talk about issues. If it's happened to them, why should the next person get justice and so forth? And then people just were like, well, I this is too uncomfortable. I don't want to deal with it. Why are you talking about it? You know?
Yeah.
And we can't get into the psyche of why people are like that. But yes, the daggers are there. There's always somebody who's going to bring you down, criticize you. Twitter, can be vicious. You can say something, go to sleep, next day you wake up, you're like, yo, wait a minute. People are swearing at me in Zulu now. I'm like asking my friend translate, she's like, who's saying these things to you? I was like, what are they saying? No, I can't tell you. Where are you? Are you saying? I'm like, no, okay. So, and it's literally, you know, but it's the vacation that I've chosen. And also, when people are pushing those type of negativity towards you, it's a reflection on them, not you. And I've learned that, and that's also come with age. You know, when you turn 40, and the years after that, you kind of think, okay, you know what, that's on you. You can call me what you want. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, this guy came on, and his girlfriend had asked for assistance online for a counselor, and I sorted out for her offline. And he came on, and he was like, Rosie's such a miserable, lonely person interfering in relationships. And
wow.
And everyone was like, oh, are you okay? I'm like, no, rather ask him if he's okay, because this is not a reflection of me. I was just helping somebody who needed the help. Within 20 minutes, I mean, we shut him down. He closed his Twitter account. He's suddenly he's not tweeting anymore. His page isn't available and so forth, you know. And so you got to expect that. But also when I tell people when you've gone through your counseling and expect that, but that's also another thing that people don't understand is what survivors do when they're in court. You know, it's very, very brave of how Cheryl Zundi handled her case.
Yeah.
But also understand that is what survivors go through on a regular basis. And working with power over these years, I've seen that. Where it's even been in some cases where a judge will like say, well, if you don't stop crying, I'm going to throw this out of court.
Jesus.
You know, you don't have a strong defense lawyer. You don't have a strong support structure. You know, seeing girls whose reporting an incident that's happened in their family and the family are against her, but she's still going forward. And then having to come to court by herself and then go find a shelter because the family had turned their backs against them. So it's all of these different perceptions, you know. And then it's also looking at the African family structure within the rural areas.
Yep.
I will speak about it, and I've been lambasted by my family for talking about it, but there was a case of sexual assault within my family where, and I was only told much, much later, but where the wife went back purely because the family was saying, well, it's his house. If you want to be looked after and taken care of, remember, a woman cannot be alone. So it's also dealing with those perceptions. Mm. And she ended up going back. And me speaking to her and saying, well, you earn double than he what he does anyway. So fine, it's a family house. But what you're earning, you can get your own room.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, and what are you telling your daughter?
Because
later on, she's going to say, well, you put me back in that situation, into the home where the man who was doing this to me.
Mm.
You know, so it's all of these conversations that we need to have at different levels. And, you know, I did a lot of work with Eve Ensler, who wrote the Vagina Monologues, and she's done phenomenal work across the continent, in fact, across the world. And one of the homes that she opened up was in Kenya, just outside Nairobi, and it's for because FGM, female genital mutilation, is a problem. Mm. It's still a big crisis in East Africa. And she opened up a home for young girls who were trying to escape it. And what she had to do was actually sit down and have conversations with some of the chiefs, because you needed that message to be trickled down to the village to say, listen, okay, we need to really change the structure. And people saying, well, we've done it for so many years. What makes the next generation so different?
Do you feel the continent is becoming more and more, especially now you are our sort of old generations, becoming more and more open to having these conversations with us?
Absolutely.
As the younger generation.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is why they wanted to keep women uneducated for so long.
Mm.
And since we're rising above that, since we're going to the grassroots level, so it's not even just about the 45-year-old woman going to get her matric. It's about making sure the little girl from day one is being told what her rights are. That is opening up a whole new area of discussion, of going against patriarchal norms, of breaking barriers, of breaking stigmas and so forth. And so, I mean, I say to people, we're going through a shift. But the last year or so, before the shift can really happen, there's like this almost this like this vibration that's happening under the soil. Nobody quite knows what's going on, but we know that change is imminent, and it's also scaring a lot of people, because now the little glass houses that they built are going to be shattered very, very soon, you know. So it's scary, but it's also very, very essential of what's happening on the continent. And then also the rise of female power is not just in medical, but it's on the financial side. It's the judicial side. It's businesses. It's science. It's technology. It's engineering. I mean, we are infiltrating places where we belong, and where a lot of women want to be, and then also in excelling at it. And this is what's also scared a lot of people, is that, you know, you put women in mining, are they going to handle it? We'll only give them heavy machinery. Well, technology has proven them wrong, because now some of the machinery that's used are very, very light than anybody can actually use, you know. So we're living in very, very exciting times, but it's also scary, because there are still areas and still territories that are adamant that it's not going to change. And that is where we need to put a lot of our focus on. We need to put focus and have these discussions with people in the village, people in our rural areas, heads of state. You know, we had the gender summit last year, and there were a whole bunch of survivors who were on stage, and they called our president out. And people saying, well, that's so disrespectful. But actually, no. One of the survivors was talking about where she was a prostitute, and she had been trafficked through the sex trade. And she says, I remember the specific conference. You were there, Mr. President, because you and your cabinet ministers were some of our clients.
Mm.
You know, so calling these different areas out. And I mean, a beautiful turning point that came from the gender summit was that a woman had been incarcerated for killing her abusive partner. And we literally, the whole room erupted, saying we wanted her to be pardoned. And a couple of months later, she was pardoned.
Yes.
You know, so and looking at her case, and it wasn't just a fact of the president stepping down saying, well, let me, you know, keep these people happy, is that her case wasn't valid. She should have been pardoned years ago. In fact, she should never have been incarcerated. you know, and if you look at the judicial system and you look at some of the women who've been incarcerated and the crimes that they've been put in for, so you might have killed somebody, but there was a protection order against that person for a while. Why didn't the police step in? Why wasn't he incarcerated before? This was self-defense, you know. So it's a lot of these things that we need to tackle and break through. And we're at the point now where it's not just the activists. You know, if power, it's our 40th birthday this year. And the agency was only registered, if I'm not mistaken, in the early 80s, purely because our laws didn't say anything against domestic violence. The Domestic Violence Act only came about, I might be wrong, I think it was 1986, if I'm not mistaken. So from the 70s all the way through to then, there weren't laws that protected women. You know, so now we've got that. So now we've created this awareness. We've lobbied. We've changed things. Now we say to people, look, this is what we've done. But it's also up to you to take the baton even further.
Now, what's the next step for Rosie in terms of your journey? I mean,
wow.
From Waka Agency to your writing, is there a new book coming?
You know, first of all, Waka Agency has been an absolute blessing. You know, I work with, I can honestly say, the creme de la creme of talent across the continent. And
please do name some of them, because I think it's amazing some of the people that you work with.
Yeah, so I've got Simba Mudirere, who represents Zimbabwe. So we got footprints across Africa. So in East Africa, we've got Tanzania, Uganda, and Kenya. So Uganda, I've got obviously Gaetano Kagwa, my ex-colleague from Studio 53. I have Flavia Tumusumi. I have Brian Malondo. Kihaka from Tanzania. In Kenya, we have Farid Kimani. Then West Africa, from Liberia, I have Patrice Jua, who's a phenomenal TV presenter, radio personality, activist. She was incredibly instrumental in changing the perception of that Ebola had in Liberia. She's also a Washington fellow. So we got Ghana, we've got Lydia Forson, Chris Ato, who are both award-winning actors and actresses. I have Mego Tanwa, who's also from Nigeria. Then the SADC region, I've got Zimbabwe, Simba Murereri. Who else do I have? Let's go to another country. Zambia, we've got Chishala Chitoshi Jr., otherwise known as Guest Groove. From Angola, we have Weza Solange. We have Donald Moloisi, who's releasing an amazing book next month called Dear Upright African. And it's talking about how the educational system across Africa needs to change, because that's also shaping our minds and the minds of our African children. So we're across the board. And so where we are now, and where my dream for Waka to be, is to be able to partner each and every one of my Waka stars with formidable brands and taking the Pan-African journey even further. So, and then of course also open up an office in East Africa and West Africa and let them run on its own. So literally just because, I mean, I'm not taking in any more talent as we speak, purely because I want to enhance the brands that we have now. And also just change the perception of African artists compared to American artists, because we're always trying to look to them. And
what's the difference there?
Well, everyone, you know, when you people say, okay, well, who's your favorite icon? There's always somebody from the West. The influence of the American accent within our artists, with what's happening on television, that needs to change. And the West are now noticing and realizing how powerful our continent is. So everyone wants to come here and do work. I mean, you look at Black Panther. You know, that was incredibly revolutionary movie of our time, because it is putting African tradition, culture, it's putting our pride up right there. And just
an
like
African this, Renaissance of sorts.
You know what I'm saying? It's like it's so beautiful. It's incredibly beautiful. So I want us to have these type of conversations. I want to, you know, I'm going to be traveling quite a bit. I can't mention it just yet, but there's an exciting thing that's going to be happening in East Africa also, where it's about nurturing talent. So I want to be able to do workshops and hopefully one day also open up a Waka Academy, where we can literally train as go back to the drawing board of as thespians, as storytellers, telling our own stories, you know. So that's where Waka, I plan Waka to go. Rosie, in her personal capacity, I suppose we'll still be the crazy warrior standing up for women.
Still reclaiming that soil as well.
Still reclaiming that soil. In terms of the book, yeah, there definitely will be another book. My whole spiritual journey has really changed in the last 18 months. So when I'm ready to talk about that, it will definitely be on that level. Just changing attitudes and philosophies one African at a time.
Amen to that.
You know, baby.
Once again, thank you so much, Rosie, for coming.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed this. It's great to sort of see how one can stand up for what they believe in.
Mm.
And that's definitely something I'm taking away from that.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Right.
Cool.
Do you have a career that you like? Well, let us know. Drop us a mail on our email below and we will definitely follow up on it.